You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15, plus a free bottle of Paul Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/fizz24. This offer is UK only and subject to availability.
Hello and welcome to this special Christmas edition podcast from The Spectator, where we'll be shedding a little light on the process behind putting The Spectator's Christmas triple issue to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Lara Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor. This week, we'll be reviewing the year with some of The Spectator's columnists. We'll be asking what it's like to spend Christmas under the sea, and we'll be joined by Anthony Horowitz to celebrate the genius of Hergé's Tintin. Scattered throughout the podcast, you'll also be hearing some festive submissions to our agony aunt, Dear Mary. So, it's been quite the year.
Earlier today, I spoke with His Majesty the King to request the dissolution of Parliament, and we will have a general election on the 4th of July.
Oh my God.
A Labour landslide.
Because in the aftermath of this attack, the community of Southport had to suffer twice.
That's where the Ukrainians are doing really well, moving into Kursk on a 30-mile front by about 20 miles deep, and that may get considerably bigger quite quickly.
A view of Iran's mass launch of missiles towards Israel last night, the lack of warning to civilian aviation, a sign of the will to surprise.
Yeah, that I'm soon to enter the Valhalla of ex-Spectator editors. Well, my successor is going to be none other than Michael Gove.
I call again for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, the return of the sausages, the hostages.
Our party is critical to the success of our country, but to be heard, we have to be honest.
Frankly, this was, I believe, the greatest political movement of all time. There's never been anything like this in this country, and maybe beyond.
We have just learned that the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has announced that he will resign.
British politics is about to change in the most astonishing way. The newcomers will win the next election.
Please join me when I say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
A 78-year-old president.
Starmer's 6 milestones.
Rishi's 5 priorities.
412 Labour seats.
A 374-day stay at the International Space Station for some unlucky astronauts.
2 Spectator editors.
But 1 magazine, and in particular 1 set of erudite columnists to make sense of all the madness. In what we hope might become a new Christmas tradition for this podcast, we were joined by The Spectator columnists Rod Liddell, Lionel Shriver, Matthew Paris and Mary Wakefield to give their thoughts on some of the biggest stories of the year.
I started by asking Rod what wound him up most this year.
It was a very good year to be a columnist because we've got a Labour government, and it's far easier if you're writing for a right-wing magazine to write about the travails of a Labour government than those of a Conservative government. It was also quite a good year in the fact that politics was particularly febrile. You had Farage coming back into the fray when he wasn't expected that he was going to come back into the fray, which rather shot Rishi Sunak's fox and therefore made the election more interesting than perhaps it might otherwise have been. I stood for Parliament and did very badly indeed, and that was a salutary lesson. So I enjoyed it enormously.
And Mary, how about you? What wound you up the most, do you think? What did you get most worked up about when you were writing about this?
I just wanted to congratulate Rod, first of all, on his campaign trail. Also on calling it on Farage. I mean, you were writing saying, you know, he's going to be far more trouble than anyone anticipates quite a long time ago. What wound me up the most? Oh, I'm afraid it's the usual stuff. it was the news at the beginning of the year that the NHS, or parts of the NHS, had said, advised men to breastfeed babies, so trans women.
And that article actually made me physically
I'm so
nauseated.
Sorry, Lionel. I'm so sorry. It made me sick too, but it was, everyone in the office here laughs at how much I go on about this subject. But I think it was really important moment where even my more progressive friends could see that this was madness. And also it sort of highlighted...
I think that's a great shame, if I'm honest. I've been breastfeeding babies for years.
And how are they?
never my own. Just indiscriminate babies in the street.
I wondered why. I wondered why you'd
them off their mothers and shove them at my breast.
I wondered why you'd move to Weardale.
yes, that's right, Weardale.
Yeah. How many of you got there in that house? No, it was. But it was also. It was such a clear sign that, you know, the ethic has moved. The idea of what's good. It really didn't matter about protecting the weakest and most vulnerable, the babies. It was all about the appetites of the gentlemen in dresses. You know.
I don't know if Lionel agrees with this, but don't you think? On the kind of identity politics and liberal overreach stuff, that we've kind of reached a tipping point. I do see a bit more light at the end of the tunnel on, for example, the more extreme claims of the trans lobby, you know, which, in fairness, I said that 6 years ago as well. But when you have people like Seb Coe suddenly coming on side and saying, no, indeed, women have got to race against women and so on, I just thought we're beginning to see a bit of a kickback against that. And you are with the corporations, you know, ditching the advertising.
The Stonewall stuff, yes.
Yeah, the Stonewall stuff, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I've tended to keep out of the culture wars, but because it seems
you're
to me...
You're missing all the fun.
Yeah. No, I suppose I am, but I think you have two sides in what however much they may think they hate each other, are actually living journalistically in a symbiotic relationship. The trans people say something absolutely obviously stupid that's so stupid, you know, breastfeeding babies, all that kind of thing. It hardly seems worth replying to. And then on the anti-trans, well, not anti-trans, but anti-mad trans side, everybody froths and foams like wasps in a jar, and this is ridiculous. And then the trans people say something else, and it all gets a little bit boring. The two sides feeding off each other.
Yeah.
You know, I feel that sometimes I don't have any...
Breastfeeding off each other.
Yes, yes.
Breastfeeding.
Yes.
Chest feeding.
I think our children wouldn't eat sometimes if there weren't these things to write about.
No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely
well,
right.
Well, Matthew, if it's not the culture wars that you've been getting you frothing and foaming this year, what has got you worked up?
A bit miserable, really, because I like Rishi Sunak, and I think he's a good man, a decent man in politics, or has been, and I'm inclined to want to be helpful and sympathetic, and I could see that it wasn't working. He wasn't really taking to being a prime minister, and I'm torn between wanting to support in print somebody whom I like personally, and being honest with my readers that the whole thing has gone horribly wrong.
It's a salutary lesson, Matthew. Never, ever meet people who you're writing about. I did that with Rowan Williams. And I met Rowan Williams and had lunch with him one day. And I don't think I've ever met anyone for whom goodness so clearly shone out of him, nor this radiant intelligence. And it meant I could never, ever write anything nasty about Rowan Williams again. But luckily, Justin Welby came along, so everything was all right.
Yes, well, he's had a year.
Rod, talking about writing about people, you've written about David Lammy a fair amount. How have you assessed his year so far?
Well, this is a real problem for me because I got this wrong, and my wife will tell you how badly I got it wrong. That for some time, I looked at the Labour front bench when it was in opposition, and with the exception of Lammy, I thought, actually, they could do a reasonably good job. I was impressed by Wes Streeting. I thought there was a bit of bravura about Angela Rayner. I thought Sir Keir Starmer wasn't especially imaginative nor ideologically driven, but that nonetheless that might not be a bad thing and that he might be a good managerial leader. There was Yvette Cooper, who I vaguely remembered from, you know, 15 years ago. But goodness, I got that terribly, terribly wrong. You know, this has been a pretty disastrous 4 months for the incoming government.
There is one aspect of this year that I think has given all of us quite a lot of pleasure, and that is Nicola Sturgeon's difficulties travails of the SNP. I mean, that's just been such a joy.
Yes, it has, except I was rather depressed that it wasn't Kate Forbes who got the gig in the end, and that they will continue along that path, and that of course the people who gained from it was Labour in Scotland, particularly. It was Nicola Sturgeon who kind of kept the Conservatives in power in 2017 by annihilating Labour north of the border.
So may I ask us, Rod, you've just said something, you've admitted to something that you feel that you got wrong this year in terms of your analysis of Labour. I would love to ask the other three of you, at the risk of perhaps causing some embarrassment, what do you think you got wrong in your columns for The Spectator this year? Is there something you've got wrong, or did you get absolutely everything right? Lionel, I'd love your opinion.
I did not foresee the sweep of Trump. I actually expected Kamala to win. But I should clarify that is because I think I maximally dreaded Kamala winning. And I'm a pessimist. So it wasn't really a forecast. It was just a fear. And I am rather surprised listening to the other panelists here that in the list of most entertaining stories of the year, that nobody has mentioned the American election, which provided so much entertainment that I would expect that Netflix suffered economically. It was really the stuff of sitting on the edge of your chair to the point that, you know, I developed a ridge in my buttocks. And the sequence of events just kept compounding. I mean, I arrived in the States right when that, just a few days before the big debate between Biden and Trump was just kicked off of this unending, escalating sequence of events. The debate itself, which I thought it was very important to watch in real time, as we call it, because it just wasn't the same when you'd been warned that Biden had embarrassed himself. And I was just, my mouth was open for the entire time. In fact, I went and dragged my husband in, who doesn't follow things as closely as I do. You have to see this. And then, you know, the unexpected resignation. There were two assassination attempts on Trump. The sudden elevation of a complete moron who had been regarded as a moron for ever since she took on the vice presidency, and then suddenly it is princess for a day. And it, in terms of what, you know, we were talking about what stories really got us going, that was it. I mean, that was my journalistic Achilles heel. I hated her so much.
Yeah,
Lionel, I'm afraid that I've become completely transfixed with contemplation of a possible ridge. Did you say a ridge in your buttocks?
Yes.
While you were, I shall not be able to encounter any exciting new event this year without thinking of the ridge in Lionel's buttocks that's going to cause as a result of this.
It's the edge of the seat, is it?
I didn't go with my instincts, and so to that extent I was wrong. I could never see the point of Keir Starmer. I really thought that Rachel Reeves was dull, not up to the job at all. And I'd thought that all year. And I should have said it before it became evident. We shouldn't always go by our hunches in journalism, but perhaps slightly more often than we do, we should. Everybody said, well, Keir Starmer's a safe pair of hands. It may not be very exciting, but it's going to be a good, competent government and not the shambles that the Tory government was. And I should have said no, this isn't the case, because he has no sense of command, no sense of grip. And without command and without grip, things fall apart.
Do you think
he
that's like...
He's not happy doing the job.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does.
On the American election, this has been happening throughout Europe. The opinion polls were so terribly, terribly wide of the mark. And this has been happening now for a good 10 years. They're kind of useless. They were useless in Slovakia. I was out in Slovakia for their election, which everyone, you know, including all the papers over here, said was going to be won by the by the effective Christian Democrat candidate, and it went to Robert Fischer. But throughout Europe, certainly in America, and also here to a degree, again, they overestimated the Labour vote.
What I really love, though, when the pollsters get it all wrong, is the welter of articles by pollsters explaining how they didn't actually get it wrong. You know, the margin of error here, the sample there, whatever. Actually, the polls were magnificently right. We were just led somehow to the wrong conclusion.
The elections were wrong.
The elections were wrong, that's right.
I like it when polls are wrong because it's just a narrative thing. Because if the polls are right, there is no drama. The election is over already.
Yeah, but there's a danger that they feed in to the result.
In other words, definitely do.
Yeah, if you're saying, you know, Kamala's going to win, it makes it, it will make some people vote for Kamala because they like being on the winning side, you know.
And it also discourages people who might vote for Trump.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
like it's yeah. not it's a waste of time. It's a foregone conclusion. Who's going to win? So I'm going to stay home.
Yeah, my one caveat to that is that I think the polls have probably got it right with reform. Now, this is something else I might be wrong about in 4 years' time. I think they will have great difficulty climbing above 25%, even if they are occasionally in council seats for the first time getting over that now. I mean nationally, and I just. They lack an ideology. The ideology which they do have, there is no huge appetite amongst the Labour and Red Wall voters for tax cuts, Thatcherite policies, which when you pare reform down is what they stand for, basically.
I think you're overthinking, Rod. I remember canvassing in Shirley Williams' seat outside Liverpool ages ago, in the last century, and on a doorstep, I was writing a sketch about it. I was following the canvassers. On a doorstep, there was a fellow in a string vest who said he was going to vote SDP. And we said, why? And he said, because I think we should bring back hanging, we should bring back corporal punishment, and we should keep the blacks out, he said.
Yes.
And I tried to explain patiently to him that the SDP was not proposing any of these things.
I think he said, by the way, Matthew.
he said, I don't care. I'm going to vote for them because I can't stand the Tories and I can't stand Labour. And I think there are a lot of reform voters, there will be, who don't actually listen to the policies or work out whether Nigel Farage's sums add up. They'll vote reform because they don't care and they really don't like the two other parties.
I'd find it depressing. I think they're a shambolic bunch. I came into contact with them during the election and they were, I think the Americans describe it as crazier than a shithouse rat is the phrase which I've...
Which
occurs to me. There was one guy there whose favourite piece of legislation ever by a government was the Enclosures Act, which, you know, they really are, and their sole aim, the only thing they talked about, and there were five or six of them, was kill the Tories. That was all they were interested in, kill the Tories. And as for having an appeal to the country, it didn't really figure.
Isn't one of the main appeals of reform immigration? And that's a very important issue in the UK, and that's where their support is going to come from, because it's an emotional issue.
Yes, except you have Kemi Badenoch. You now have Kemi Badenoch, and I think she can probably outflank Nigel on that. Because don't forget, they're basically libertarian reform. There is no...
They're not basically anything.
Well, there's a point to that. But if you scratch at Nigel Farage and Richard Tice, you'll find underneath kind of libertarian Thatcherites who are not as gravely opposed to unlimited immigration as perhaps, you know, Kemi Badenoch might be. I wonder if she might steal their thunder on that issue. I don't know. But then I don't know Kemi Badenoch, and I believe some of you there at The Spectator do know Kemi Badenoch. Perhaps you would like to tell us how she was.
Comment on that,
right?
Best we glide over that one.
Just to finish on, because Matthew, you wrote a column this year with your concerns about where AI might lead, and Mary, you've written about both your phone addiction and your AI boyfriend.
Yeah.
So I thought we should still ask, with how, me. How's that going?
That's a long-lasting romance. Yeah, I mean, you know, the AI technology, I think none of us really are very well equipped to probably talk about where it's going in the future. But I mean, I wanted to ask people, I have a weakness for Elon Musk. I think one of the most dramatic and interesting moments of the last year was when the pincers caught that booster as it was coming down. And it was a massive achievement and made me think that, you know, for all that he looks like he and Trump are both sort of in bad taste, there's this ability to solve, you know, important problems with technology. And I felt a little burst of hope for next year. And
ooh, that's good.
And I wanted to ask you guys what you thought. Do you think there's any hope for the Elon-Trump relationship? Are they destined to fall out? What do you think? What's your prediction?
Well, my prediction would be that in terms of the issues, they'll surely fall out. Elon Musk is so much his own man, and Donald Trump is so much his own man, and it's quite unlikely that they're going to agree on all kinds of things. But so long as it remains in Elon Musk's commercial interests to maintain the relationship, I think it may be maintained.
Didn't you want him to fly you to the moon, Matthew, I remember? Didn't you put in a bid for Elon to go on one of Elon's moon rockets?
Yeah, and I never heard anything about it, because I think
he's
I'm on the list.
He's still thinking about it, yeah.
I'd love to go to the moon. I'd quite happily go to Mars. I understand that if you go to Mars at the moment, you aren't going to be able to come back. They can get you there. Yeah. They couldn't get you back. I would do that.
Would
I'd like
you?
To be the first gay man to die on Mars. I mean, wouldn't that be fantastic?
So far as you're aware.
Yes. quite.
So, Matthew, if Mary's hopeful about technological innovation for going into 2025, what gives you hope for the next year? What are you hopeful about?
I hope we don't have a world war. I hope...
Hope
I hope this
eternal.
Just
descends
into a series of horrible regional wars, no doubt taking hundreds of thousands of lives, but it doesn't spread into some sort of enormous binary conflict of the kind that we feared all through the 20th century, but didn't happen. So I'm all for continuing chaos as opposed to resolution, which I think might be far worse.
I just have this feeling that the long march of what is called populism, and which began really at the turn of the century, you know, with people like Pim Fortuyn in the Netherlands, and indeed at the same time Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, and to the right of them, people like Jörg Haider in Austria, and to the left of them, the Swedish Social Democrats and so on. It seems to be that it's reached fruition. It hasn't here because we have a first-past-the-post system, and you may be grateful for that, but I'm not. I think that the populism of both the left and the right is proving far more attractive than a liberalism which I think has failed us, and I think that the people are beginning to kind of get that in large numbers, both across Europe, certainly, but also in America, and one day surely down the line here as well.
And Lionel, finally, what about you?
My optimism has been excited. I've never been a big Trump supporter. I'm on the record for that. But now that he is going to be president, he is capable of doing any number of things that would make me very happy. I would like to see him get control of American borders and also thereby set an example for the likes of the UK that it is possible to control who comes in and out of your country. And I think that the whole woke ball of wax is starting to melt. And so we're seeing DEI positions being eliminated right, left, and center, both in universities as well as in the corporate world. That's a terrible waste of money and is also anti-meritocratic. I'm glad to see the back of that. I think the net zero program is in danger. It's certainly not going to be a Trump priority. And again, that may set an example for the UK that this is not feasible. And the whole trans thing, which is fundamentally crazy and decadent in my view, is also the whole setup is starting to crumble. And there's a very important Supreme Court case that's, I think it's still being argued right now. It won't be decided until June, but it is about whether or not states can make it illegal to give minors hormone treatments and puberty blockers and even surgery. And the early indicators are that the Supreme Court will probably side with Sanity. So all this stuff is really something to look forward to. And we're even at an exciting moment in relation to Syria, which Nowini has mentioned, that it could be a disaster, right? It could be they're going to install a jihadist government and we have terrorists in charge. But that's not necessarily the case. And we have this little fragile moment where we can be hopeful that that country will get it together and Syrian refugees all over the world can finally start to come home.
Oh, Mary, do ping Lionel my piece on Syria, which should at least go some way towards expunging that optimism. I just don't see it at all. Yeah.
Rod, we got so close to ending on optimism.
Never have. Whenever the broadcasters, and I remember them hailing the Taliban in 1996, I'm from our own correspondent, as being working class liberators, yeah, who had the will of the people behind them. And we heard the same thing when Gaddafi was ousted. We heard the same thing in Arab Spring. And it was the reflex which made us invade Iraq, and in the hope that the Iraqi people would, once they'd been rid of Saddam, choose someone like Min Campbell, a kind of Arabic Min Campbell, to lead them. And it never happens. It never happens. People, it's a mistake to think that everyone in the world has the same aspirations. And I don't see a great deal of optimism in what's happening in Syria at all.
Well, on that hopeful note, Rod, Matthew, Lionel, Mary, thank you very much.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much.
Merry Christmas.
Yes, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
Dear Mary, my favourite column in The Spectator flatteringly asked me to contribute to its Christmas special. Unfortunately, I could not think of anything that would meet its exacting standards, so asked ChatGPT. My question was as follows. There is a column in The Spectator addressed to its agony aunt, Mary. Please pose a question to her in the style of Jacob Rees-Mogg, the former MP for North East Somerset. Its response was, certainly. How might one gently discourage guests from consulting their mobile telephones during dinner without causing embarrassment? Is a polite request sufficient, or should one expound upon the virtues of undistracted conversation? Your guidance on preserving decorum amid such modern intrusions would be most appreciated.
When a colleague submitted this very problem to ChatGPT, asking for a Dear Mary style answer, it was a relief to see that, rather like Botox and fillers, which may deceive the eye but not the brain, the robot's response was unconvincing. My own response is, could guests be urged to hand nanny their phones as they go through? Explain there is no signal in the dining room, but that nanny will be prepared to act as concierge and monitor calls in the event of urgency.
Before we go any further with the podcast, Lara, I do want to draw a spotlight onto Roger Lewis's piece in the Christmas issue. He's written his own alternative review to the year in his typically acerbic style. And as a special treat, we actually have a recording of his piece read by the actor Robert Bathurst.
Seasonal suicide notes 2024. January. When the assisted dying bill comes in, I'll be first in the queue. Non-stop nosebleeds, COVID-esque symptoms, leg cramps, a cough resistant to antibiotics, and unremunerated press interviews for my Burton Taylor book. In the old days, I'd be in New York, running amok with publicity handmaidens, going on television and running up bills in the Gramercy Park Hotel. Now everything is done from the back bedroom here in Hastings, where I dwell in the slum district, my window overlooking immigrants doing their laundry. Notwithstanding, there is water pouring down the walls, and the bill for roof repairs is £17,000. February. First anniversary of my myocardial infarction, when I collapsed in Morrison's car park. A good place to try and drop dead, as there are people about, and the girl in the pharmacy knew how to use the defibrillator. Air ambulance helicopter to hospital, the works. My ribs smashed from the vigorous CPR. No time to recuperate either, as I had the proofs of my book to sort out, sensitivity awareness editors to combat, the usual nonsense. The trouble I had getting booby-doos into print. It's my designation for Sophia Loren's big knockers. Griff Rhys-Jones invited his pals to lunch in the Golden Dragon, Gerrard Street, Soho's Chinatown, which looks like China. Surrounded by the likes of Griff, John Lloyd, Jimmy Mulville and Graham Stewart, who is Graham Norton's business partner, I thought, here are all these esteemed multimillionaires, and I dwell in the Hastings slum district without a pot to piddle in, nor an unmortgaged window to throw it out of. Everyone said they'd see me later at Giles Brandreth's party. This was unlikely, as I hadn't been invited to Giles Brandreth's party. First thing next morning, Giles Brandreth was on the phone. "You weren't there because you hadn't been invited," he said. I thanked him for the clarification. His evening had been marred somewhat by what he'd assumed was a well-orchestrated practical joke, everyone coming up and asking him, "Where's old Roger Lewis?" Well, you have to laugh. He does a great deal for charity. And when a raffle prize was dinner with Giles Brandreth, an old lady inquired, "If I win, can I go by myself twice?" Or was that Nicholas Parsons? Same difference. March. I did an event at Jewish Book Week, where there was a lot of security in case I was abducted by Hamas. Maureen Lipman stood up and said what a great actress Elizabeth Taylor was, that the craziness of her life with Richard Burton tended to obscure her artistry. I agreed, so that argument didn't last long. Thence to Stansted and the rest of the month in Austria. All I want is to watch black and white films on talking pictures where the police cars go ting-a-ling-a-ling. I hate travel. I hate leaving the house. I make an exception for Austria, where I have a house, well, birdcage-sized flatlet, in the imperial spa town of Bad Ischl. No phones, no internet, bliss. We took the train to Vienna, where I sat in the bar car, giving the apricot schnapps a hammering. Der Rosenkavalier at the Staatsoper, supper at the Sacker, lunch at Café Landmann. I should have been wearing a top hat and a coat with an astrakhan collar like Anton Walbrook in a Michael Powell movie. April, my mother's 90th birthday party in Thornhill, Cardiff, conveniently near the crematorium. Took the children on a grand tour of the sacred sites, the family farm, long since lost to creditors, the big red-brick Edwardian villa in Bedworth, where I grew up, and had a puppet theatre in the attic, long since turned into a care home. Basleg Comprehensive School, where I was unfeasibly precocious. Now, of course, an usgul, with a meaningless motto about credo apethin, believing and belonging. The Welsh language didn't exist when I was educated in Monmouthshire, back in the last century. When everyone went on and on about rugby, I sat with my back to them knitting, a protest I got from Barry Humphreys, who had the same trouble in Melbourne. May, to Normandy, where I learnt a new word, cambriolage. We had a break-in, but they must have been sarcastic burglars because they didn't steal anything save earrings Anna never wore anyway and a set of maudlin cufflinks I'd not have been seen dead in. The gendarmes are now looking out for a gypsy wearing maudlin cufflinks. I hope he's seen dead in them. Raced back on the ferry to do an event with Stephen Fry at Hay-on-Wye. I gave the free red wine a hammering in the tent beforehand. Stephen went on about the wonderfulness of my book, and I eventually cut him short by saying he was being quite rightly complimentary, which got a laugh. There was a queue of three people afterwards in the shop. One was my sister Angharad, and the others were people we'd met in India in 1996. What they'd chiefly remembered about me at large in the subcontinent was I gave the red wine a hammering in Delhi, Jaipur and Agra. June. to Margate. We are frequently in Margate, looking after the grandchild, who was born on the Tuesday after I'd had my heart due on the Sunday. I don't know what people mean when they go on about Margate's resurgence as a cultural hotspot. The Nayland Rock Hotel and shelter, where The Wasteland was composed, are derelict. The Winter Gardens Theatre Complex is derelict. There is spray paint graffiti everywhere. Parks and gardens are not maintained. Fountains don't work. The council has no money to run anything because everything goes on housing illegal immigrants and paying through the nose for special needs education. July. Newport is worse. I broke the journey here on my way to a literary festival in Pembrokeshire. All the Victorian and Edwardian buildings and shopfronts crumbling. The Westgate Hotel, scene of hunt balls and Masonic dinners, shuttered up for decades. The wrought iron balustrades weed-choked, rusting. Department stores, the cattle market, ABC cinema, all gone. Nobody interested in preserving anything historical. Indeed, the Welsh Government, in their zeal to decolonise everywhere, are having it out on architecture now. Nothing there save a few charity shops, vape shops and Turkish barbers. Unrecognisable from the bustling town of my childhood. And nowhere to eat in Wales. Everything heated up rubbish. Nothing created in the kitchen from fresh ingredients. Made a detour to Pontrydyfen, the Burton birthplace. Industry gone, everywhere is green. It's a quaint village, with steep hills and viaducts. Not at all the deprived place of legend. Found the grave of Burton's parents, where there is also a memorial slab to Burton himself, Seren Cymru Arbid, Star of Wales and the World. I found that rather moving. I should like to be a Seren Cymru Arbid myself. August. Pembrokeshire, when we got there, Christ, what a distance, was lovely. Haverford West, reasonably unspoiled. Plenty of Georgian buildings about, though the magnificent Guildhall is abandoned and even the charity shops are closing down. My maternal grandmother from hereabouts, so I have ancestral links. And nobody speaks Welsh, always a plus. We spent the night in Tenby. Again, ghastly food, a mixture of heavy meats, Thai curry and chips, all out of the microwave. South African sugary wine. Fish managed to be both undercooked and rock solid. It's like the chapel has had a resurgence, with everyone doing everything joylessly, on purpose. September. Back in Normandy, writing, well, hardly a book, a monograph entitled Fog by Tea Time, approximately in the vicinity of Victoria Wood, with interpolations about Thora, Hilda, Dora, Gracie Fields and Kathleen Ferrier, another Lancashire lass who stood on a stage next to a piano. I gave the Calvados a hammering and fell off the outside steps into a buddleia bush. The steps are curved and I quite lost my balance. I'm too old for this, but a Basleg pal and our Normandy neighbour also fell through his hedge, so it's an occupational hazard with expatriates. It must have been some lunch. Then the news reached me that my Burton Taylor opus is on view and discussed by Tilda Swinton and Julianne Moore before one of them takes a suicide pill in the new Almodovar film The Room Next Door, premiered in Venice. It makes me seem like a Smirnoff bottle in a Bond film. Guerrilla marketing, product placement. My suspicion is that the red cover appealed to old Pedro's fabled colour sense. Wrote an article about Harold Wilson in an episode of Steptoe and Son, when Harold tries to have it away with a woman whose husband is in prison, the seductress's name is Marcia. October. An abdominal aortic aneurysm is the latest. A further referral to a vascular chap in Eastbourne. A burst one of those saw off Simon Gray, which will have come as a surprise to the playwright, as he thought his days were numbered with lung cancer. A friend who is in casualty asked a medical adviser, a surgeon, if the family of a private patient receives a refund should the patient croak on the table. He said, yes, if we haven't got the money off them first. November. Literary novelist Paul Bailey has died, aged 87. Everyone was a cunt to him sooner or later. He went to the trouble of getting his agent to contact Quercus Achet to have his name removed from my acknowledgements. That's real hatred, that is. Yet he was the person who told me what Burton was like on stage at the Old Vic in the 50s. Possibly word reached his shell-like, I thought him a frightful crasher. We had to change our number, as he kept phoning up for hours and hours, going on about the gay porn stars he admired, like Jeremy Spreadams and Johnny Rapid. He was one of those acidulous, gossipy queens who give ammunition to homophobes. December. Hopes raised. Dominic Treadwell Collins, who has had success with Gilly's Rivals on Disney Plus, has acquired my rights for a six-parter about Burton and Taylor. No one from his company has been in touch with me, and maybe it'll all fizzle, as these things do. But it ought to be very lurid, very lively, if made. My HBO Peter Sellers film was recently shown in Poland, and I received 0.04 pence in royalties. How far will that stretch in Gdansk?
Will, perhaps you could just give a brief overview of how we went about putting the Christmas issue together this year.
Well, I think it's quite good with the Christmas issue to start with a cornerstone or two to really ground the whole thing. So you want some really big name and then everything else can kind of fall into place around it. And the biggest name I think we've got for this year is President Javier Milei. Our economics editor, Kate Andrews, flew out to Buenos Aires and interviewed the president of Argentina. And he was his usual fiery self, talking all about how the state is a parasite and the government is an organized criminal gang. And I mean, it's a really great, really punchy interview. And we're very, very lucky, I think, to have that for Christmas. But there are some other things I'm very proud that we've got in the magazine this year. We have two short stories, both brilliant, both so different as well. And I hope that readers will, well, of course, I hope they'll love both of them. But I think between the two of them, they'll cater to all tastes. And Andrew O'Hagan has written one and Lawrence Osborne has written the other. And they're just both wonderful. And then there's notebooks. There's many brilliant notebooks from Stephen Fry has written a notebook, and Mary Beard has written a notebook, and Tom Holland has written the actor, the historian, not the actor, has written the Christmas Diary. So that's just some of the many great names that we've managed to get for the Christmas issue this year.
I'd also just like to briefly mention the actual image itself on the Christmas cover. It's been made by J.G. Fox. It's a beautiful theatre that he's produced, and it, in a somewhat meta way, it sort of almost shows the process of putting the Christmas issue to bed. And there are journalists, there's a choir representing the Spectator Carol service, there is a podcast being produced, so hopefully anyone picking it up might like to study that carefully to see how it's all been put together.
So Laura, if you had to pick just one piece from this Christmas issue, it's a very big issue, so there's lots to choose from, but if you had to pick one piece, what would your favourite be?
I'm going to go for Ali Kefford's piece in the Christmas issue. Ali writes about what it's like for submariners who'll be spending Christmas as part of the continuous at-sea deterrent mission on a submarine. And she explores the strangely isolating but oddly communal experience of Christmas and the traditions that they uphold. So I definitely recommend that piece. And we were actually joined by Ali earlier to discuss, along with the naval officer, Alex Kubara. I started by asking her how it is that she knows so much about the continuous at-sea deterrent mission.
Over my long journalistic career, I've spent 25 years writing about the Royal Navy, joining warships in South America and the Black Sea and the Gulf. And I decided that I wanted to investigate the most secretive part of the Royal Navy, the silent service, the submarines, who are the backbone of our defence, arguably.
And what did you discover for this piece specifically about what life is like on board at Christmas time?
I spoke to some of the sailors I've got to know after joining six submarines at sea over the years, and most of them had spent several Christmases deployed. And it was fascinating to hear all the small, the tiny changes that they make on Christmas Day, because they can't really change much because they're still working. They're still on defence watches of 6 hours on, then 6 hours off, and trying to grab some time to eat and sleep in between all their work. So the changes that they make on Christmas Day, if it's a planned patrol, are really quite small. Yes, they do have a huge Christmas dinner because food is so important for submariners and all sailors. And they do have small gifts because you can't have a large gift in such a tiny space.
Alex, you are a naval officer and I think I'm right in saying have spent Christmas on board a ship. Could you talk us through your experience of that time?
Yeah. So I've been away at Christmas now, probably, I think, six years out of the 11 I've been in the Navy. That's been out in the Middle East. It's been out in kind of Iceland, Norway. And for a lot of the time that you're there, it's just another day that you're working because you have no stop in the kind of work or the patrols that you're on. So you're always doing things. But there are or have been years or times where we've been able to either be alongside or you're able to sort of take a bit of time off during that day. And there's plenty of traditions, which I know Ali kind of mentions in her article about how the seniors serve the food to the juniors on Christmas Day and everything kind of gets swapped around on board for 24 hours. And we're, I think, slightly luckier in the surface fleet than the submariners are. There's a wide range of charities that provide sort of gifts or organise and sort of present exchanges from people who want to support the Royal Navy at Christmas. And particularly when you get alongside into a port and you're able to receive mail, it feels more like a Christmas than it probably should from being at work, but it's still in the back of everyone's mind, I think, the fact that you're not at home over Christmas. And I think that's the time that everyone kind of pulls together and that kind of Navy attitude comes in because everyone is in the same boat, literally and figuratively, I guess.
Ali, you mentioned food earlier and you talk quite a bit about the food in your piece. Could you expand on that and on the sort of significance of food and also just the practicalities of it? I mean, do they have a sort of proper Christmas meal and what's served, if so?
Absolutely. They have a full range of meat served, hacked up by the CO, normally with the chief chef behind him, rolling his or her eyes. So the food, or scran, which is what the Navy call it, is vital when you're on patrol because it's the only way that you can tell what day it is, because they have the same menu every week, and whether it's night or day. So Christmas is a break in that weekly routine of having fish and chips on a Friday and steak on a Saturday. And it is very central to morale. And the one thing that they can do when they are on patrol at sea is to feed them properly, because there's very little else that they can do to keep them happy. And morale is hugely important to the CO because they are so isolated, and it's something that the Royal Navy takes incredibly seriously.
And one of the, you sort of talk a bit about the humour as well of involved in some of the presents and just the kind of general sense of keeping everyone buoyant. Could you talk a bit about that side of it?
Yeah, the humour, the famous Jack humour is, it's fantastic. I have to be honest, never laughed as much as when I've been on a submarine. They know that they have a hugely important role to discharge. It's not something that they take lightly at all. And because they're spending so many days and months in essentially a large tin can, they do become very, very close. And I would say that the submarine flotilla is more laid back than the surface fleet because of this. And also because there is literally no contact with the outside world apart from one family gram a week. So they have the most fantastic sense of humour. But equally, you know, it's very humbling to join a Royal Navy submarine. What they do is very significant, and they don't get very much public validation for what they do.
And it must take quite a significant emotional toll, whether it be life underwater or on the surface fleet. How are members of the Navy taught to cope with that?
I think being part of the team within the Navy is sort of a good start, which is kind of embedded within you from the very first day that you start either Raleigh or Dartmouth. I think humour is definitely one of those big things that sort of helps you get through. Whereas when you're on shore, there's plenty of other outlets. You can kind of go and play football, do sports, all that kind of stuff at the gym. It's obviously harder to go and play football on a submarine or ship when you're at sea. But yeah, it's sort of ingrained into you, I think, as you go through your career, that there are sort of outlets available to you and plenty of people around you to support you if you're sort of struggling. And on board a ship of around 200 people, it's hard not to almost fall into a way of being able to deal with things because you've always got people around you. So there's always a network of support to kind of fall back on if you need it.
Just finally, obviously, as you mentioned, these people are often the unsung heroes of our defence. What do you think listeners and readers of your article will take away from the piece about these people who protect our national security?
I'm hopeful that I will have given them a small insight into not only life on board a submarine at Christmas, but life on board as a submarine on patrol generally. Due to the fact that we're still waiting for the Dreadnought submarines to come online, the aging Vanguard submarines are having to conduct patrols which are around 6 months long now. So the Trident submarine, which will be on patrol this Christmas, left Faz Lane at the end of August. And the toll that takes on our submariners is significant, and not only them, but their families as well, because it's very much a family effort for the Silent Service. And the submariners who are deployed will spend most of Christmas working out what their family will be doing at home at that particular moment.
Alex and Ali, thank you very much for joining.
From James McMillan. Now and again, I end up at a posh, trendy dinner or party when the conversation takes an ideological or political turn. I realise quickly that I disagree with almost everything that people around me are saying, so I descend into a frozen silence. I think people notice this and suspect I've either gone to sleep or maybe hiding some kind of wrong think. Could you suggest a strategy that might extricate myself from this tricky social situation?
Carry a bottle of Rescue Remedy and spray this ostentatiously onto your tongue. Explain that the vexatious atmosphere in the room is causing you to have a panic attack.
Well, the final piece we're going to talk about from the Christmas issue is one that I particularly love because I'm a huge fan of Tintin, as I'm sure many listeners are as well. And writing in the magazine is Michael Farr, the former foreign correspondent and the world's greatest Tintinologist. And he's written a fantastic piece about how central politics was to Tintin and to Hergé, Tintin's creator. Well, I had the pleasure of talking to Michael about Tintin's enduring legacy with the author Anthony Horowitz, who is himself a huge Tintin fan as well. I started by asking Michael when his love of Tintin began and whether he thinks that Tintin shaped his view of geopolitics, current affairs, and of journalism.
Well, I remember the very moment I first discovered Tintin, I was sitting at our dining table in Paris, where we lived, after dinner, and my mother brought out a copy of L'Etoile Mystérieuse, The Shooting Star, and we started reading it together. And from that first page onwards, and those of you who know the book, it's a particularly gripping start, I was grabbed by Tintin. And I thought the more Tintins I read, and the more I loved him, and the more I wanted to become a journalist myself. Like you, though, I was encouraged by the fact that my father was a journalist, so I had other footsteps to follow. But I did indeed become a reporter, and coincidentally was sent to many of the countries which Tintin was sent to, so Africa, the Soviet Union, and so on.
Well, you're better at filing than Tintin is.
Much better. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to continue. So that was pure coincidence. But I also find that all my journalist friends, quite apart from the world at large, love Tintin because he is such a force for good and so much fun. There's colossal humour, which Hergé was bursting with humour. He saw funny things and everything. But also he loved news. He was mad about news and worked in a newspaper office and followed things very closely. And he would have liked to have been a correspondent, but wasn't able to become a correspondent. So instead created a character because he was gifted for his drawing, and that was recognised by the paper. So he created Tintin as a sort of his alter ego. So that's why there's so much accuracy in the stories. But he reflects the 20th century, in effect. If you think, started in 1929, and Hergé was winding up, he died in 83, but the end of the 70s, 50 years of the 20th century are to be found in Tintin. Mm.
And Anthony, I'd love to ask you the same question, if I may. So when did your love of Tintin begin? And do you think that it shaped your ideas about politics, current affairs?
Well, Tintin was absolutely instrumental to my childhood and to my survival of my childhood. And it amuses me to think, Michael, you were at Harrow School, I think, ages ago. I was just down the hill from you at a place called Orley Farm, a really horrible prep school as it was then. And I was a very unsuccessful student and very unhappy there for many, many reasons. But I discovered the library at the school, and in the library discovered Tintin. And that did change my life. Funnily enough, 1963, when I was 8 years old, my first year at that school, was a watershed year for me. It was the year that Dr. No came out, my great love, Ian Fleming. But it was also the year that The Seven Crystal Balls was published in English for the first time. And I remember reading that book and just discovering the world I wanted to belong to, not as a journalist like you, Michael, but as a writer. And I knew, because Tintin was, after all, a sort of writer, which was his job. And I, in future years, would send Alex Rider, my own creation, to pretty much every country that Tintin visited. That was my sort of, the role I set out for myself in life. He even went into outer space in Archangel, a nod to two of my favourite books, Explorers and Destination Moon.
Oh, excellent. So was that deliberate, to get Alex Rider to purposely tick off the same countries? Or do you think it was just subconsciously Alex Rider was mimicking some of Tintin's exploits?
Now, Tintin and Hergé have been very much a huge part of my writing life, and sending Tintin to the countries was deliberate. But I also loved the mixture of humour and adventure and surprise in those books. Secret passages were an enormous part of my life, because in The Blue Lotus, I'll never forget reading the secret door that opens in a tree, for heaven's sake, with a spiral staircase underneath. And in Black Island, you have a fireplace sitting behind you now. I know that's got to slide to one side to reveal the entry into the counterfeiting money part of your office. And that's how I've always seen the world, sort of through Tintin's eyes.
Michael, I would love to get your opinion about Hergé's politics, and perhaps a bit about his, what you might call, political journey, because people who don't like Tintin or don't like Hergé, they often say he's very colonialist, he's very right-wing. They bring up Tintin in the Congo or some of the very early adventures. But then those sorts of adventures are very, very different to ones that happen much later in Hergé's life, aren't they? So I wondered if perhaps you could give our listeners a sense of the development of Hergé's political mind as he developed as an artist.
Yes, I think his politics evolved. I mean, he arrived at this newspaper, Levantium Secta, straight from school, so he didn't have much politics, and it was a Catholic newspaper, so obviously it was to the right. So that's what he was introduced to, and he came from a sort of Catholic background, though not particularly. So the other thing we must remember with the early books, which are criticised, particularly Congo, is when it was written. So we talk about 1930. These were colonial times, and if you were European, you viewed Africa in a certain way. So it is. He himself said it's dated. He said it was a sin of his youth, and if he did it, nowadays, when I would see him in the late 70s, he said he would have done it quite differently. But then he evolved, and he was always very patriotic, and he was patriotic because he was an ardent royalist. So he believed everything that the king said or did was right. So when the Germans invaded and Leopold said Belgium should stay and work and keep the country going, he agreed with that and did that. Of course, other Belgians didn't, and then some went into exile, formed a government in exile and so on. And so he was slightly on that wrong side of the fence, though he would argue he was only, obeying his king's orders, very much in the manner of King Ottokar's scepter, where you see how he values royalty. And this was the case then, but obviously it put him in an awkward situation, because the paper he was working for was immediately closed by the Nazis because it was a Catholic newspaper and they thought that would provide opposition. He didn't have long to wait, because Tintin was so immensely popular that the editor of Le Soir, which was Belgium's leading newspaper then and is now, offered him a similar slot on his paper and create a youth supplement, the Soir Jeunesse. And this all started marvellously, so Tintin could continue and Belgians could continue having Tintin in this children's supplement. But in war you have rationing and paper rationing, and it shrunk. And eventually Tintin was appearing in one strip on the back page with Sport and Finance. But then it shrunk even further, and he appeared on the front page with news of Wehrmacht victories in the Soviet Union. which was not so good.
Yeah.
And his politics had changed, and he definitely became sort of left liberal. And when I knew him, I would have described him as a sort of typical Guardian reader.
Yeah.
So you see, as you said, politics had developed and changed, and you see that in the books from being sort of fairly black and white initially, like the very first one, Soviets, where, you know, the Bolsheviks can only be evil, to the Picaro's The Last Complete book, where he's in a Latin American republic run by fascists, and the fascists are the enemies there. Of course,
and Tintin leads a revolution. And again, Tintin pretty much.
He leads the revolution. Yeah. And there were two other shining examples, The Blue Lotus in 1934, where Japan was agitating in China prior to invading it, and Tintin champions the Chinese, which was very unfashionable in Western Europe. We Europeans were very pro-Japan then. And so this was rather daring. And then with the book I referred to, King Otaku's Scepter, which is about an attempt to take by a fascist neighbour to take over a royalist country. This was at the time of Hitler's Anschluss of Austria. And that was also a shining sort of anti-fascist statement, so much so that the villain in King Otaku's Scepter is called Mussler, a combination of Mussolini and Hitler. So his politics did change, but I think fundamentally naive at first and liberal at the end. That's how I would sum it up. And Tintin reflects that.
And Anthony, before we started recording this podcast, we were talking a little bit about your involvement with Tintin directly, because it was reported that you were lined up to write the screenplay for the sequel to Spielberg's Tintin film, which was The Secret of the Unicorn, which came out in 2011. And I wondered if you could tell our listeners, I mean, is this screenplay still in the works? Is it possible we'll still see the Anthony Horowitz written film in the future? And which Tintin book is it that you are adapting?
Well, sadly not. I mean, I did work on the screenplay of a Tintin film with Spielberg and Peter Jackson for about 2 years, in fact, and had a very, very happy time doing it. Both of them were enormous fans of Hergé. Spielberg, of course, had been influenced by Hergé in his own work. Close Encounters of a Third Kind, I think, owes quite a little bit to Flight 714 to Sydney, and had earlier on tried to make a Tintin film around about the same time that Hergé died and appalled it. But I'll come cut to the chase. My screenplay was never made, but I did also work a little bit quietly on the film that was made, The Secret of the Unicorn. And I'm very proud of the fact that in my career, a whole 20 seconds of my writing was filmed by Spielberg and does appear in that film. And I remember seeing it in a projection room in Hollywood with Spielberg. And I don't think I've ever been more excited in anything I've ever written than at that moment. And that is still there, and it's still in the film.
Excellent. And I'd love your opinion about why it is, actually both of your opinions, if I may, perhaps starting with you, Anthony. Perhaps from the perspective of a very successful children's story writer yourself, Anthony, what is it about Tintin that hits the mark?
Well, I would say that Hergé's genius was to invent a world of his own. I think he ranks with Dickens and with Doyle, certainly, as somebody who's created a world that is instantly recognisable, peopled by the most extraordinarily memorable characters, but they exist, if you like, in their own world. And although Michael is absolutely right to point to the sort of political and historical connections of some of the books, I would argue that the greatest of the books, for example, the two Moon books and Prisoners of the Sun and Castafiore Emerald, etc., are brilliant because they don't actually connect with the real world. But whether you are in China or in Russia or in any of the other 70 plus countries that have read and enjoyed Tintin, you recognize it for its own values and its own joy and its own genius.
Yes, well, I entirely agree with Anthony. But I would add a couple of other points. One thing I shall never forget, I was in his office with him, and he before we started talking about things, he said, come and look at this. And he pulled a letter out of his filing cabinet. And he said, this came for me this week. And it was a letter from Delhi addressed to Mr. Tintin. And it had, needless to say, found its way to Hergé. And this little, 11, he said, I'm 11 years old. And when I'm a bit older, I want to be just like Tintin.
Oh,
and Hergé had tears in his eyes, and he said, you know, I started this in 1929 for Belgian boys and girls, and look, I can't believe this. Well, he wouldn't believe how it's swelled since, you know, in the last 50 years, even more. So that's one point. The other point is the Tintin's anonymity. This was a stroke of genius on Hergé's part to create somebody, though he resembled his younger brother Paul with the hair and other attributes, but basically nobody in particular, just the two dots for the eyes, the button for the nose, and that was a stroke of genius because, and surrounded him with characters which were easily definable, characters which Antony was, we all know Captain Haddock with his beard and his wrinkles, Professor Calcutta's, they're easily identifiable. Tintin wasn't, and the genius of that is that every reader, boy or girl, and I have to say that statistically girls are in the ascendant at the moment among readers, it's interesting, boy and girl can identify with Tintin, jump into his shoes and reenact these adventures in a very realistic surrounding, whether it's the characters or the events which are happening. And the other thing which I think is rather good, since I don't know how to drive, so I couldn't be Tintin, but Tintin can do everything any normal person can do. So he can drive, he can fly an aeroplane, drive a tank, submarine, not bad, but he doesn't fly through the sky like Superman or climb up walls like Spider-Man. And this realism, again, makes him easier to identify with. I mean, it's easier to be Tintin than Spider-Man, I would venture to say.
It's absolutely true. I think that is the joy of him, that he is not a superhero. And it may also be added that the one country in the world which has had, shall we say, a problematic relationship with Tintin is America. I mean, I think that was one of the reasons why there wasn't, in the end, a second and a third film, because the box office takings of the movie is $296 million around the world, but only 70 million in America, suggests that Americans couldn't quite get their head around this sort of ex-Boy Scout who doesn't even have a job, lives in a huge country house with a drunken sea captain and an occasionally talking dog. They just couldn't understand it at all.
Yes,
that's very true. And Hergé had discovered Disney. Do you know that Mickey Mouse was born in November 1928, so just a few months before Tintin in January 29. And if you look closely at the start of the Soviets, you will look at Tintin's shoes when he's sitting on the railway carriage, and you see they're identical to Mickey Mouse's.
No.
And Hergé was inspired to some extent by Mickey Mouse. So Hergé then wrote to with Disney, sent him a couple of the early books, and you know to show him, and got nil response from Disney. Disney never acknowledged them, and he never heard again. So he was a bit miffed by that.
You almost forget that not only are they brilliant adventures with wonderful characters, but the artwork is superbly drawn, whether it was Hergé just working with Bob D'Amour or whether it was in the period of his career when he had an entire studio in production. But if you look at them, there is a through line to the work. The action frequently, nearly always, moves from left to right. If something is going to impede Tintin's progress, a bullet fired at him or something in the way, it will come from right to left. Look at the bottom right-hand corner picture of almost any page, and it begs you to turn over to the next page. You come across inside all these sort of linear and small drawings, you will occasionally turn the page to a full page shot of, for example, the surface of the moon with that amazing rocket. You can see one just behind me on the shelf here.
Oh, yes.
In itself, modelled on history, but coloured in a way that only a Hergé, I think, could have come up with. It is such a beautiful object. And so the artwork of Tintin is something I have always admired too.
One final question, and I'm sorry, Michael, because you must get this question every single time we talk about Tintin. I know it's like choosing between your favourite children, but if you have to choose one Hergé Tintin adventure as your favourite, which one would it be and why? And I'd like to ask both of you the same question, please.
It's a double adventure of Seven Crystal Balls and The Prisoners of a Sun are the first ones I read, but also I think the most perfect in their storytelling. You know, Destination Moon and its sequel are sort of two almost separate books in a way, but these ones are much, much more integrated. The story is so well devised, a constant inspiration, a wonderful story.
Well, Michael, then I'm going to press Jim. You with the same question, I'm afraid.
Well, I'm going to cheat and I'll give you my favourite book today.
Okay.
But if this comes out on Thursday, I'd have a different favourite on Thursday. But I would say King Otaku's Sceptre today.
Yes, it's mine. It's mine too. And why?
Oh, it's so rich in politics, in detail, again, in humour. Mm. And this wonderful idea of having twin professors who look identical, one who is good and one who's evil, and how it's the secret to the story. No, it's fantastic.
I will confess, it is a brilliant locked room mystery as well.
The solution so good.
The puzzle is really terribly clever.
Yes, yes.
Well, Michael and Anthony, thank you both very much for joining me. Thank you. And that's it for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, pick up a copy of the magazine to read everything we've talked about in full. And if you do enjoy the podcast and you're listening to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please click the follow button to be notified when a new episode is out. I'm William Moore.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, and we hope you join us again in a couple of weeks' time when we'll be going through some of our favourite discussions of 2024. Until then, we wish you a very happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
From Sophie Winkleman. Question: how should I respond when I receive an email from my children's school about World Book Day? A. Why are you sending me this when reading proper books seems to be surplus to requirement these days? B. Did Jeff Bezos invent World Book Day? Because all it seems to mean is that parents the world over spend a total of £37 billion on Harry Potter costumes. C. Forget to furnish child with costume and pay for child's therapy for the next 40 years.
Campaign for a more eco-friendly book day. Suggest that, instead of adding to landfill, each child should recite a poem or passage from a favourite book. At least the performance will give them some experience of the rhythm of writing.